a case for secession and for Cape independence. You might have seen the flag outside on the flagpole. It is the red, white and blue, reminding us of our ancestry with the Netherlands first founding the Cape of Good Hope, and the anchor in the middle of a white cross, reminding us of our Christian heritage. And Cape Town's symbol has been for more than 500 years the anchor. So that's the flag of Cape Independence. Jeremiah 6 verse 16 to 17 declares, "Thus says the Lord, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where the good way is, and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls. Also I have set watchmen over you, saying, listen to the sound of the trumpet." And we are called to sound the trumpet like Nehemiah did, to call for people to unitedly defend those areas of the wall that are under attack. The cost of unstable, inefficient, expensive, unreliable energy in South Africa is a staggering 89 billion rand per month in lost production, lost revenue and wastage. You can imagine the damage that it causes just for some poor soul who's trying to run a restaurant. You half cooked a meal and suddenly there's a power failure next to yours. You're going to lose the customer. You're going to ruin the meal. It's, how do you recover from things like that? The average business can't all afford to have their own generators and so on. Now, it's no laughing matter, but South Africans need a sense of humor. So this is the sort of thing that some people do. Mowing the lawn with a man sitting on the lawnmower with his hand clippers. And yes, some people have put up things like this. Load shedding, proudly brought to you by the ANC. In fact, they are the powers of darkness for sure. ANC, some people said, could stand for another night with candles. I've tended to use ANC as short for abortion, nepotism and corruption, or abortion, necklacing and communism. You can use quite a few different analogies. But my favorite is to write cancer, small c, capital ANC and small er. And I've been doing this for many years, maybe over 10 years now, and a lot of people have picked it up on social media, referring to the cancer government, because a cancer is a cell that doesn't aid your body's health, but breaks down your body's health. And so the ANC really are a cancer. And there's all kinds of memes like this. You would have noticed how many times you've heard from Eskom CEO, there'll be no more load shedding this winter. And we've been assured that by Ramaphosa too. At the State of the Union address, he said, load shedding is behind us. I think the next day we went to level six. If he was Pinocchio, his nose would be very long. Now, this was brought out by the DA several years ago. And at that stage, they said the cost of load shedding to the economy had been 300 billion. And the salary and bonus of the former CEO of Eskom was 22 million rand, a bonus. That's a performance bonus. Performance what? How did the man even get paid for the job he didn't do? And the cost of installing a backup generator for President Zuma and Kandler was 275,000 rand, taxpayers' money. And the average annual salary of Eskom's 46,000 employees is 633,000 rand. And you can tell it's dated back to before 2018 because it mentions President Zuma. And estimated budget overrun for Medupi and Kasuli power stations, 176 billion overrun. How on earth is it possible that already they're talking about it, that it cost 326 billion rand to build these two power plants, which at that stage hadn't produced any energy? And these are some of the latest power stations that they've built. Of course, this is our nuclear power station, Cape Town. I remember the 11th of November, 2005, first power failure we ever experienced in Cape Town. We were having a public meeting in Pilots Town Hall, and suddenly, 11th of November, 2005, total power failure, the whole city of Cape Town, out. Some poor Italian tourist was stuck in a cable car suspended over nothingness between Table Mountain and the cable station for over 2 hours, and the tour guide was apparently slapping them to stop them screaming and getting hysterical. I'm sure they must have spread good word when it came to tourism when they got back to Europe. But we had absolute chaos. People in shopping centres, pitch dark, there was no backups. Nobody knew about backup generators because we'd never had a power failure before. And that was Kuburg Nuclear Power Station. The engineers that were there hadn't done a proper maintenance. They had the degrees, they had the papers, but they weren't doing the job. They had to call back the Boers who had been load shed or had been cut out of the company to come back from Netherlands, and they added a zero to the contract as consultants to clean up the mess that the BBBEE affirmative action appointees had created. It. We almost had a Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in Cape Town because of BBBEE Eskom policies, where they kick out people just because of their race, and they put in people who are not properly qualified, but they belong to the right political party. This is one of the new generators that have been built under the Zuma-Ramaphosa time, and this is one of the reasons why we had a power failure. The whole power plant broke down. And here's some of the shrapnel from the generator that went through the roof. Here's some facts put out about Eskom. 1991, they had 27,000 employees, and they produced 42 gigawatts. 2013, they had 46,000 employees, they now got 48,000, and they're producing 38 gigawatts. So you're paying more people, and you're paying 10 times more for your electricity to get less, as you know. Eskom typically pays 5% above the market average. And do you know many RDP housing townships don't have to pay for electricity, and they don't have load shedding in many cases, whether electricity is free or not. And throughout our so-called load shedding power failures, South Africa's kept supplying Botswana, Namibia and Zimbabwe, sometimes even Mozambique, with electricity, where they don't get load shedding. So isn't it funny, we who pay for it get the load shedding, and the people who don't pay for it, they don't get power failures. Electricity will spike each year because they know how desperate you are, and they will continually increase the costs and make it difficult for people to get electricity. And crime rises in the areas that go dark because they know the electric fences don't work, the security systems don't work, the panic buttons don't, unless you've got a backup generator. And there's so many other things, such as the closed circuit TV cameras that won't work. So power failures are a real pleasure to the criminals. And then you see strange things like this, where, for example, in PE, you've got a whole lot of illegal wirings coming out of the substation. And what are they going to do about that? Nothing much. So the devolution of Eskom, you know, evolution. First they have electricity, then they've got kerosene lamp, then they've got candles, and after a while you'll be down to rubbing sticks together. Now, don't worry, Eskom says they're on top of the situation, they're investigating. And President Cyril Ramaphosa has regularly spoken about the fourth industrial revolution, but we've reached stage four of power failures before we've reached the fourth industrial revolution. So somebody suggested maybe what's going on is the president's phoning a tech advisor saying the country's not working. What's the solution? And he says what many computer techs say: have you tried switching it off and on again? So keep switching the country off and on again, maybe it'll start working. Which is what, so often when I've got a tech problem and I go to a webmaster, what do I do? And he says, just shut it down and start it up again. So some of the greatest songs of Eskom Unplugged: Candle in the Wind, Dancing in the Dark, Ray of Light, Moonlight Serenade, All Night Long, and I've Got the Power. Well, actually they don't. So they were after a new symbol for Eskom, and people thought maybe a candle would be better. This is the debate in Parliament over Eskom, and you can see how well our elected representatives are paying attention. We don't always supply you with electricity, but when we do, we ask you to please not use it. Sort of like in California, where Governor Newsom has told everyone to get rid of the fuel cars, only have electric cars, and then they told everyone, please don't plug in the electric cars to recharge batteries because the power grid can't cope with all the electricity demands. So you've got to have an electric car, but you're not allowed to charge it with electricity. Make sense? Where do you get any CEO of a company saying, please don't use our product? And you've heard all the promises from Cyril Ramaphosa over the years, and you remember that back in Zuma's years, he appointed his vice president, Cyril Ramaphosa, to investigate and resolve the problems with Eskom. So he can't blame someone else. It's actually been his responsibility long before he became president too. However, they do have an ANC handbook with 101 excuses and lies for the modern politician, and they've been working by the playbook a lot. Why is there power failure? The coal got wet. a conveyor belt broke down. How many times have you heard that one? And there's just, and somewhere along the line, somebody came out with, we've discovered that the only way we're going to end load shedding is that we need to do regular maintenance on the power stations. Who would have thought? You've got to maintain power stations. Central government in South Africa is corrupt. It is complicated, it is frustrating, and it is unnecessarily time-wasting. But don't worry, President Cyril Ramaphosa says they consult the ancestors. And they regularly call on witch doctors to open different ceremonies and to dedicate the ANC. And in fact, we shouldn't just laugh at the ANC for this. You remember when National Party was the greatest political power in the country. 40 years they were in power. And then F.W. de Klerk had his Secretary General, the Canary, we called him. Who is the chap who was Minister of Defence for a while, who had only been a canary in the army, he had been just in the choir? I'm just forgetting his name for a moment. Here's our chief negotiator for the National Party during the Kadesa events.
Rolf Meyer, yes.
So Rolf Meyer hired witch doctors to design a new corporate image for the National Party. That's when it came out of the scrambled eggs and so on. And then he had witch doctors dedicate the National Party's political office in Soweto. And this Rolf Meyer, who's meant to be a Christian, had this witch doctor sprinkle entrails of a goat around him and sprinkle blood on him and so on as part of dedicating the National Party offices in Soweto to the ancestors or something like that. And shortly after that, National Party disappeared. It went from hero to zero. It went from the greatest political force in this country to absolutely gone, finished, kaput, never seen again, you know, and into the dustbin of history. So I wouldn't say that getting the witch doctor support's got a great track record. Opening of Parliament didn't used to quite look like this, but this is how opening of Parliament became under Jacob Zuma, and people being assaulted. This, by the way, is a member of Parliament, DA, but still he was a member of Parliament, getting a water cannon by the police and then dragged off, even though he had his gold card around his neck showing he's a member of Parliament. Opening of Parliament and assaulting a member of Parliament while they're about it. And His Excellency arriving behind armour-plated glass, because obviously he didn't trust the people that much. And then opening of Parliament by the honourables didn't seem very honourable after a while. It just became more of a riot. I mean, this is what our Parliament degenerated to. And racist black economic empowerment and affirmative action policies with racial quotas are not only required in business, but even in sports, for goodness sakes. Even in sports quotas. And this has led millions to leave this country, including over a million skilled workers. Now, bear in mind that every skilled labourer, on average, provides employment to 10 unskilled labourers. So losing a million skilled labourers means you're losing employers and people who enable more employment. With over a million skilled labourers having left South Africa over the last 23 years, the cumulative loss of employment to the country is absolutely staggering. Every year that the ANC has been in power has added approximately a million more unemployed. We had almost 2 million unemployed back in 1994 when Nelson Mandela was given control of the country. Today we've got 30 million unemployed, more actually, because when they put their numbers of unemployed, they play games. They've got unemployed and then they've got what's the other one? Economically inactive, and then they've also got another category of discouraged work seekers. What's a discouraged work seeker? Unemployed. But instead of just putting it all together, they've come up with three categories of unemployment to keep unemployment separate from economically inactive and discouraged work seekers. So now we've got 30 million unemployed in the country. So well done, ANC. In 30 years, they've managed to put 30 million people in unemployment. But don't worry, because as the President said in his State of the Nation address, 26 million people are on some form of social welfare grant, which actually should be a disgrace, shouldn't be something to boast about. The best thing you can do for somebody on welfare is get them off it. That's approximately 10 times more than the economic income tax base for the country. So we've got 10 times more people on welfare than are paying income tax. South Africa is being looted with a 3 trillion rand budget, which is primarily a feeding trough for the political elite to enrich themselves at the expense of the general population. The amount of money they spend on caviar and alcohol and entertaining themselves, and you had people here who were improving their home renovations, and put the entire extended family up in the most expensive hotel in town at the cost of hundreds of thousands of rands a week, in Table View Hotel, while their house was being fixed, which was probably being done by the taxpayers' money as well. Corruption reports received just in 2016, the closest I could get a report from, an average of 11 reports of corruption a day. And schools, 16%, 7% road traffic, licensing, 6%, immigration, 6%, housing, 5%. Who do citizens of South Africa consider most corrupt? People working in a police service, 66% respondents. Home affairs officials, 38%. Officials awarding public tenders, 37%. Politicians at national level, 37%. People working in judicial services, 36%. Politicians at the provincial level, 31%. Politicians at local level, 27%. What do all those people have in common? Politicians all the way up, and police. And then officials issuing building permits, 16%. Business permits, 16%. People working in the public health sector, 11%. Other, 3%. None of the above, don't know, 2 and 5%. So corruption is endemic. And politicians have become akin to really a pig's feeding trough. Nelson Mandela said famously in 1994, I'm going to stop the gravy train. Well, he did stop the gravy train in time to load a whole lot of ANC cadres on board, and now it's steaming ahead faster than ever before. And they still have their snouts in the trough, there's no doubt about it. And broad-based black economic empowerment begins to look more like this, very broad, lots of gravy. Corruption and the ANC go together. The C could stand for corruption. Corruption is killing us. Governments create wealth in the same way that ticks create blood. I remember one time when my wife was brought up in Austria. She's absolutely allergic to any creepy, crawly things with multiple legs. And she got me on the phone. She was speaking so loud, I sort of had to hold the phone away from me. My son had come back from the farm with a tick. And she didn't know what to do with this. And so I raced home, and there's my daughter and my wife in the bathroom watching. Calvin's plainly got this tick buried into his shoulder. So they're watching me with fascination as I took some Vaseline, covered it with Vaseline, and saw the tick come out. Now, being brought up in Rhodesia, finding ticks was normal. Every day you'd be out in the bush and you'd have to get the ticks off you before you had your bath and so on. And so this tick comes out, and you could see him pulling his legs out of Calvin's shoulder. And as he got out, I used the tweezers, picked him up, put him on the counter, started to run across the counter, smacked the tick, blood splurted everywhere, screams. Then my daughter Daniela said, whose blood is that? Your brother Calvin's. More screams. Now, you only get teaching opportunities like this on rare occasions. So it was an educational opportunity. So I said, this tick is like the government. It's a blood-sucking parasite. It doesn't do anything good. It doesn't create anything good. It doesn't contribute anything. It just sucks the blood out of healthy organisms. And so the word politics is made up of two syllables. Politics. Poly, many, ticks, blood-sucking parasites. Politics, many blood-sucking parasites. Instead of governments creating wealth, it's more true to say that corruption creates poverty. The government does not create wealth, but the government does create poverty. And you can see the more government you get, the more poverty you get. And here's one example, somebody shared on Facebook, an official bridge opening ceremony in Kwakwa. It only cost 11 million rand to build this culvert, which they now call the bridge. And can anyone explain how it cost 11 million rand to put a concrete slab across a little culvert? But anyway, this is, if you want to know why government's so expensive. Every day our newspapers are full of corruption stories, all kinds of corruption. And so we've got cartoons like this. Department of Home Affairs. You've come to fake IDs. Go past pension scams, stopping at bribes. Fake passports is third door on the right. You can't miss it. And then Gauteng ANC, please wipe your feet. And there's the rugs made up of the Integrity Committee. And these Gauteng ANC people walking in, MECs and MCCs, walking across the Integrity Committee. One of the slogans of the ANC was, working together, we can do so much more. And somebody added underneath, crime. And that's true. working together, we can do so much more crime. So vote ANC, a worse life for all. Vote ANC if you want abundance of crime, legalized rape, steal from the whites, we'll actually steal from everyone, corruption, increase in fraud, and be the new Zimbabwe. Sullivan Communist Party says, do it for Chris Hani. Unite behind the ANC and the alliance. Many people forget that the ANC is actually only part of a tripartite alliance. And every single ANC leader and president has always been a senior member of the Politburo of the Southern Communist Party. The Southern Communist Party is the senior party, senior partner in the tripartite alliance. The ANC, COSATU, and the Southern Communist Party work together. And the Southern Communist Party has continually controlled the ANC from the beginning. And the Southern Communist Party was at one stage completely controlled by the KGB during the height of the Cold War. The ANC is actually a criminal enterprise and has been from the very beginning. From the beginning, they were just a bunch of murderous terrorists, and now they're just a bunch of mafia thugs. But what is the difference between the mafia and the ANC? The mafia turns a profit. And the difference between organized crime and ANC? Organized crime is organized. Even Archbishop Desmond Tutu is like the prophet of the ANC. He ended up saying that South Africa under ANC is worse than apartheid, which I think most of us who've lived through both can say, yes, that's true. Even Malema has said it was better under apartheid. Well, in many ways it was. Certainly education and life expectancy was better, and you didn't get power failures, and you didn't get starvation and so on. People were safer walking anywhere. You could walk in townships back in the 80s without seeing a burglar bar or security gate. Now you won't see any doors and windows without security gates and burglar bars. So failed ideas from the 19th century are now called progressive. What are people's concerns? It's clear most citizens are deeply concerned about the rampant crime and horrific violence which has escalated throughout the country. A lot of what the politicians come out with, people aren't that concerned about. The average person is not saying, we need green energy, I'd like to have more power failures so we can close down more of our power plants and rather trust in some solar panels that have been made in China and probably don't work or cause fires. And people are concerned about this. They don't want violence and riots or universities burning. Arson and breaking of windows by protesters, smashing police car windows. You know, why would the Cape be interested in independence and secession? I mean, why would we not want more of this? Burning buses, burning police vehicles, more and more violence and riots, even on the grounds of union buildings, which used to be a beautiful picnic spot for families. Democratize higher education now. What does democratize higher education now mean? Fees must fall, like you're going to get free education and all this. Fees must fall. And of course the EFF stands for Everything for Free Party. I want everything free now or I'll burn everything. And this does kind of look a little demonic, doesn't it? And these kind of scenes on universities, who would want to send their kids to a university where they could get wrapped up in this kind of riot or be whipped up to this kind of hysteria, that they're burning their university buses, for example? Or this kind of chaos that was taking place in Pretoria at one stage. I was visiting and they were just burning everything they could on the streets, and especially these trucks. How much do these trucks cost? How much does the contents cost? What does this mean for everyone in increased insurance premiums and all the rest of it? And looting stores. How can you run a store when there's a chance that you're going to get everything stolen in a matter of a few moments by some thugs and mobs? And people running down the streets with hammers and burning everything. What does this cost? You wonder why bus tickets cost so much more? Well, look no further. Or the price of things in the shops. We've had so many pentechnicons burned out and looted. And this represents a huge amount of loss for some businesses. Some businesses, this might be their main asset that's just been learned. And nothing shows that you care about democracy more than looting a Nike store and running around and stealing all these shoes, or looting local shop, burning down university campuses, or the beautiful town hall, irreplaceable town hall in Bloemfontein, burned out, and the local town councillors laughing about this and saying it's wonderful. And then Hout Bay has always been liberal, English liberal, encouraging squatters, encouraging illegal land invaders, and what the thanks they get? They get burned out, they get everything smashed, looted, upturned. Thank you, Hout Bay, for welcoming us in. I must say, Bleeding Heart Liberals and English Liberals really ask for this. And they've encouraged a culture of violence in the country. I don't think these people are carrying the bricks because they want to build anything back better. You know, Biden spoke about build back better, but they don't build anything. Nothing's back and everything is just backwards. Nothing is better. And this is what the ANC has created, a lawless culture. More than 500,000 South Africans have been murdered since 1994. 500,000 people, that's the population of some cities. That's just staggering, the amount of people murdered since the ANC took power. So to show you how evil South Africa was under Favut, for example, we had an average of 64 people murdered a year under Favut. And we had an average of 25,000 murdered a year under Mandela. See the improvement? South Africa suffers from one of the highest rape rates in the world. They say right now, a woman's got more chance in South Africa of being raped than getting a higher education. In fact, if they get a higher education, they're probably going to get raped while being there because that's what goes on university campuses at night. Almost everyone is deeply concerned for the safety of their family and particularly of their children. I think sending your children to the government schools and especially to government universities now is akin to child abuse. And sure, we do need to say we've had enough. But if we've had enough, why do we keep voting for the same people? To vote for the ANC once was unfortunate. To vote for the ANC twice is unbelievably stupid. To vote for the ANC 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times is terminal insanity. And the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. We are the future, and people are burning and looting everything. Fees must fall or shut down the country. Well, I don't fully understand that. I had to work an 8-hour a day, 6 days a week job at the fire brigade to put myself through college and end college without having massive debt. Nobody was handing out free anything to me in the 80s, and I was too male and too pale to get any kind of bursary when I studied at theological college. And back in the early 80s, on the heyday of apartheid, as they called it, bursaries only went to black and colored people, didn't go to whites, that's for sure. Not for me, not at theological college. So, you know, some of us had to work to put ourselves through college, and then other people just wanted all free. And what are they specializing in? Most of them are specializing in drugs and orgies and drunken bouts. Very few students are really serious about their studies. Proof of this is 86% of those who start tertiary education don't finish. So that means the vast majority of people in university shouldn't be there because they're not going to graduate, they're not going to finish. And even those who finished, some of them didn't really pass either. They were just pushed through. Now, would you want to be trying to talk sense to a demonstrator, a protester like this? And this fees must fall nonsense went absolutely berserk. Where in the world can you get totally free education? Everything costs, and if it's valuable and worthwhile, it's going to cost quite a bit. I didn't mind paying for my education. I never thought anyone else was responsible to pay for my college bills either. UCT will pay. It's just UCT is not a person. UCT gets money from the taxpayers because it's a government hospital, a government university. So UCT will pay means that the taxpayer will pay. Let hardworking people who've been working hard as plumbers and electricians and builders, let them pay my bills so that I can have a cushy life and have drug parties at university. Education is a powerful tool. Notice how well this man thinks ahead. He didn't realize that powerful wouldn't fit in that side, so he had to go on to the next line. Education is a powerful tool. And he hasn't got one yet. And this is what these students were doing, smashing up university campuses, looting, smashing. Why would you not want to have people like that on a university campus? And they were running around just smashing, burning everything. However, on this occasion, University of Durban-Westville, the Chancellor said he is grateful that at least not much damage was done. No, they only destroyed a few vehicles and they burned out the library. And so the Chancellor says at least not much damage was done because who cares about the library? Is the library even relevant in a university these days? So congratulations, fees have fallen. Now you can study here for free once they've burned everything down. I mean, the mentality, people like these are not worth giving any education to. And University of Cape Town, I remember when this happened, January 2015, I'd never sent any of my children to UCT, but my daughter was on the campus that night because she was part of a ballroom dancing event that was in one hall, Molly Blackburn Hall, I think, to the side of Jamison Hall. And she said that these thugs, they looked like EFF people, came running into the hall and ripping off oil on canvas paintings off the wall, which we're going to take outside and burn. They had a bonfire at the base of Jamison Steps. And so Daniela, being an artist, stopped them and started pushing them out the door. And she said, "Dad, not one of the men in the dance class helped her." And I said, "Well, Daniela, first correction, they're not men. They might be males, but they're not men. If they let a young girl take on these rioters and thugs without coming to your help, they're not men by any standard. Remember, not every male is a man, not every man is a gentleman. Not every female is a woman, not every woman is a lady. There's standards." Well, then she said, "Dad, they looked like they hated me." I said, "Daniela, these people do hate you. I mean, have you heard what the EFF sings?" I said, they looked like they wanted to kill me. I said, "Daniela, they do want to kill you." And she said, "Dad, they looked like they were demon-possessed." And I said, "Daniela, I'm sure they're demon-possessed." So, I mean, quite right then, I had this mixture of pride in my daughter's courage and fear for her safety that she's willing to make a stand. But shame on those so-called men, those males, who didn't make a stand. Desecrating a war memorial for the dead. How sick and disrespectful is that? These are for the people who died in the First and Second World War who were students from the university, and people desecrating that. I thought you never desecrate graves or memorial stones. I would have thought. And Fuller Hall, this lady after whom the woman's residence at UCT is named, was a feminist leader in the women's rights movement, and these people probably don't know enough about history to even know who they are desecrating. And why would you not want to have people like this on your university campus dancing on the tables that people are meant to eat on and so on, and ripping up original oil and canvas paintings, smashing them up and burning them, stoning them, and then having ceremonial burning of irreplaceable original oil and canvas works of art? I must say, these guys don't realize what they're doing is proving Hendrik Verwoerd right, that you can't have integrated education. Do they really understand what they're communicating? Who on earth can respect so-called students like these? This is not any respect for education. Destroying, do they know what young Christian Smut stood for? Do they know what these jammy shuttles are to help students get up and down the campus? Burning down the buses isn't going to help the students, except maybe increasing their muscles by forcing them to walk. So jammy shuttles all burned out. This is what these fees must fall, roads must fall creeps did up at UCT. And having worked in the fire brigade, I know this is not a nice job to run around putting out fires. Education is a powerful tool, yes. This woman, you could see it went viral on video for a while. "Abolish science. We mustn't have science. Science is racist. We need to turn to the witch doctor," she says, before she opens the iPads. I don't think she realizes where iPads come from, but it's not from the witch doctors. And yet, the ANC continually wants us to go back to paganism. If you want to know why higher education has stayed its in, meet the Minister of Higher Education. Can you guess his political affiliation? You will be shocked to learn this man is actually the General Secretary of the Sullivan Communist Party. Who would have guessed? And he's Minister of Higher Education, so look no further if you want to understand why our education is in the state it's in. And this has led to a major growth industry of independent schools and homeschooling. Homeschooling was quite novel when my wife and I started, and my daughter Andrea was in the first matric dance ever organized by homeschoolers in Cape Town. It was very well organized too. And wonderful seeing the growth in homeschooling and the growth in Christian schools over the years. But remember, this is just a vote of no confidence in the government's education. I would just add, how would you like to see the Minister of Education sending his children to a government school? Can you imagine? Can you imagine the Minister of Health going to a government hospital? No, none of them. I think they should pass a law that all cabinet ministers must only go to government hospitals and their children must go to government schools. If they don't believe in their own product, why are they there? Could you imagine a CEO who doesn't believe in the product of his company? But we've got that in our country. They can't even spell school. How can we entrust our children's education to the hands of people who cannot spell school? And an education isn't what you think it is. I think this is quite a useful meme to show. What is education today? Well, transgenderism, no Christianity, no praying, Darwinism, Planned Parenthood, yes. A lot of what they call education is systematic indoctrination of children's minds into what benefits the government. Societies are far gone in depravity when toleration is considered a good in itself without regard to the thing tolerated. Should policemen be tolerant of crime? Should a firefighter be tolerant of fire hazard? Should a doctor be tolerant of disease? Some things you mustn't be tolerant of. I don't think we should tolerate anything that's unhygienic in a kitchen, for example. So why is it now that toleration is now virtue, no matter what the matter is that you're tolerating? We go to schools and we seek to minister there, and it's so important to get the gospel back into schools, and praise God for all those who are faithful Christians, who are teachers and principals. It's a hard job. But in the meantime, we need to look at our local school as a place to pray for and to visit and to distribute Bibles and gospel booklets. And of course, alternative Christian education like Back to the Bible Mission in Mpumalanga are doing a superb work, and it's so vital that we fill the gap as governments have failed. There used to be a time that government schools opened in Bible reading and prayer and hymn singing and had Bible teaching subjects at school, but that's far gone. Even the theological seminaries and universities now are anti-Christian. So you can't go to university now and expect to be trained in theology. Now, of course, most people are deeply concerned for the economy, the lack of jobs, unemployment, inflation, and the deteriorating buying power of the rand. People are horrified this week that our petrol price went up, what was 60-something cents? Well, I remember when petrol was less than 60 cents a litre. I remember when petrol was 25 cents a litre. I remember when 5 rand could fill your tank. And now 100 rand won't get you out of the empty if you're... or the needle will still be on the E. And it will be more like 1,000 rand to fill the tank of your car now. My first mission by motorbike, driving from Cape Town to Joburg, it cost me 32 rand petrol to get from Cape Town to Johannesburg, 1,400 kilometers, 32 rand petrol. I don't think young people today realize how much they've been stolen from. Economist Stephen Mitford Goodson, who was once the director of the Southern Reserve Bank, author of books like A History of Central Banking, he is a regular friend and visitor and guest speaker at Reformation Society. Stephen Goodson stated here that the buying power of the rand has deteriorated to 1/500th of its buying power in 1982. So to put that in perspective, 1 rand in 1982 could buy more than 500 rand can today. And I remember when it was like that. I spent 1,000 rand in 1981 to buy my first motorbike. Brand new, out the shop window, Honda 250 XL. 1,000 rand to buy a motorbike. Today, you couldn't buy a bicycle easily for 1,000 rand. Forget about a motorbike. And when you think just how far... So, in 1982, it cost 2 rand to buy a hardcover Bible at the Bible Society, any language. Today, it'll cost more like 200 rand per Bible. Where does our currency come from? It's created effortlessly out of thin air as loans, mostly on computers, blips on a computer screen. By who? Central banks and initially commercial banks, additionally, have created currency effortlessly out of thin air. So why are you working so hard to pay off the seamless, endless amount of debt and interest on it? I mean, that's something usury, charging of interest on loans. But the government, which has got no end of corruption and service delivery and power failures, they are wanting to direct you to take out your anger on statues. You see, it's the fault of some statues. If you can get rid of these brass or stone statues, all your problems will be solved. And how many people fell for this roads must fall, fees must fall, diversion, ignoring the government's complete failure? Vandalism and arson, destroying university campus buildings, vehicles, buses, trains being burned, all this can only aggravate the situation. The price of buses or taxis or trains is too much. So you burn the taxis and trains, what happens? Prices go up. The service delivery is slow. Well, burning things down isn't going to make it come any faster. and there's not enough housing on a university campus. Well, burning down some of the housing is not going to improve the situation. But that's a communist idea. But it drives away employees, it erodes investor confidence, it devalues the rand. The massive erosion of pensions and savings and earnings, particularly the last two decades, has been catastrophic. Think how many people worked their whole lives, paid their taxes, paid off their loan, and finally at the end they retire and they own their house. And now they've had to go back to work in their 60s, 70s, 80s even, in order to pay for their homes, which they can't afford anymore because of rates and taxes. And rates and taxes are forcing homeowners to sell their properties and go into a rental place because of the rates and taxes, which is in many cases not being used at all for service delivery, but just being looted for the political criminal class that are now running the city councils. Think of deforestation, the destruction of so much of our environment, including laying waste to entire forests. We used to have forests all around Cape Town, all around Signal Hill, all around Devil's Peak. Celia Forest, Constantiaburg, Constantia Forest. All these forests are gone. They've burned them out or chopped them down. Massive arson. Huge amounts of arson around Cape Town, organized by the ANC. The ANC, I remember when they had their anniversary event in 2013 in the Greenpoint Stadium, and said, you must make the Cape ungovernable until we rule the Cape. And over 500 arson fires started around the Cape Peninsula in that next year, including the Rondebosch Common, which was 85% burned out in that same year, 2013 to 2014. We had fires over the whole of Table Mountain, the whole peninsula had fires. We are 10 million trees less today than we were in 94. I call the Ministry of Forestry the Ministry of Deforestation. They've chopped down a lot on the guise that it's not indigenous trees, pine trees and so on, but what have they planted in its place? But more to the point, government paid contractors to chop down the trees, but where did the money for all the wood go? The wood's valuable. I'm sure that was another kickback corruption deal. And this has taken in Cape Town, fires caused by arson. Huge amounts of arson destruction caused by politically motivated criminals, and the poor firemen have got to work around the clock to fight these kind of fires. And of course, many firemen have gotten injured. Some have died in trying to combat these fires. These things take lives. And this is the Neisner forest fires that happened a few years ago. Absolutely devastating and destructive. Again, arson being organized. In many cases, they organize forest fires so that they can then move into forest reserve and set up a squatter camp of people who've been moved in there to help vote for the political party that sponsored this. Destruction from the arson around Neisner, Plettenberg Bay. Hotels destroyed. Then we can talk about widespread litter, destructive pollution, major threat to the environment. Plastic litter being thrown around by short-sighted people, and then potholes. I remember in Kenya being told, in some parts of the world you drive on the left of the road, in other places you drive on the right of the road. In Kenya, we drive on what's left of the road. In fact, I heard also that in Kenya, only a drunk driver drives straight. In other words, if you're not drunk, you'll be trying to skirt the potholes. So a drunk driver drives straight. And then the litter, what does this do for the environment? What does this do for food supply? The pollution, the litter. This is beyond disgusting. This is in a city that used to be called the city whose streets are paved with gold. People used to come to Johannesburg and be amazed at the wealth. Well, now they're amazed at the litter and the pollution. And of course, believe it or not, when plastic goes into drainage, it causes blockages. And surprisingly, there's therefore flooding when the rainy season comes, because the municipality never thought to either stop the pollution or litter or to clean out the drains before the rains came. And think of all the damage to the wildlife on our land and on our shores and the oceans around us. This is Durban Harbour. And just, doesn't this attract tourists? Wouldn't tourists want to come to the Golden Mile to see this kind of litter? And on the beaches. Because what goes into the ocean will come back up on the shores at some stage. Litter is an absolute disgrace, and it massively impacts on our country as an attractive tourist destination. Think of the impact on jobs and the economy and the viability of the country. It's an immense impact, because Cape Town tourism makes a massive impact. many people's jobs are directly related to tourism. You chase away the tourists. I mean, if a tourist gets mugged or has a bad experience or sees horrible things or gets trapped in a cable car above the town in a power failure, this will be spoken about back home and it will negatively affect people's plans and where they come. And people come to Cape Town because they want lovely beaches, and or Durban used to be famous for lovely beaches. And this is going back quite a way to have such a nice looking beachfront. And this is what Durban beachfront used to look like. This is what it can look like now on a public holiday like New Year. In addition, there should be serious concerns for the erosion of free speech, freedom of conscience, and freedom of religion. Just think, during the lockdown lunacy, COVID cult, masquerade madness, the abortion clinics were open, but the churches were closed. The casinos were open, but the Bible studies and churches were closed. And you had to walk around wearing a mask, and you weren't allowed to breathe free air. So I remember sometimes going places, and they said, "Where's your mask?" And I said, "I've got a medical condition. I need to breathe oxygen." Okay. The CRL Commission has proposals to require all religious practitioners to register and be regulated by the state. What's a religious practitioner? Could that be someone who posts religious things on the internet? Could it be a Sunday school teacher, a choir leader, somebody who sings in a choir? What's a religious practitioner? Could it be somebody who just shares his faith or distributes tracts on the street? So it's such a vague term. Despite widespread opposition and the legal evaluation that this legislation is unnecessary, unworkable, and unconstitutional, they're wanting to go ahead. And then they've got a hate speech bill being promoted by the Ministry of Justice. It should be called the Ministry of Injustice. And that poses a massive threat to freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of association. Free speech has been beaten to death in the name of tolerance. Now, of course, there is hate speech. Some people might come up, they want death to all juice. Now, I don't know if they're talking about orange juice or guava juice or lemon juice, but I've got a feeling that this guy's not good at phonics. Maybe he's referring to a group of people. But freedom of the press and other foundational freedoms are at stake. These should be non-negotiable in any free country. So what is wrong with our country? In a few words, corrupt, greedy, incompetent politicians. Unworkable, unaccountable centralization. Black economic empowerment, affirmative action, racist job reservations, racial quotas in sports, guilt and manipulation, the politics of guilt and pity, in one word, socialism. And yes, as a result, a lot of systems overloaded. Welfare junkies, inflation, chasing away job creators, chasing away investors, chasing away tourists. That's what's wrong with the country. A police force that's soft on crime and tolerant of corruption. But don't worry, hand in your guns, the police will look after you. Because they're on the job. And what do you have to worry about? You've got a police force. And they BBBEE, very broad. What's wrong with this country? No municipal rights. The worst thing that this government has done, and they've done a lot of bad things, but I think the absolute worst is the uni cities. We used to have workable suburbs. Paul ran Paul. Mitchell's Plain ran Mitchell's Plain. There was great sense of pride in the different areas. Brackenfell ran Brackenfell. Stellenbosch ran Stellenbosch. To have Simonstown as part of Cape Town is ridiculous. Simonstown's a unique, separate city and culture. When I was born, there were 250,000 people in Cape Town then. Cape Town was that area between Table Mountain and the harbour. Cape Town was not Sea Point, Cape Town was not Camps Bay, Cape Town was not Rondebosch. These were separate entities with their own town council and their own mayors. And it ran well, it was efficient. When I was converted in Pounds, we knew the mayor, he went to our church. We knew the town councillors. I mean, some of them were deacons in our church and elders. And so you could walk to the home of a person who's a city councillor to the mayor and speak to him. Now, you've got to go downtown, battle traffic, find parking, pay for parking, of course, find the right level floor in the civic centre, and then be told, the man with the key is not here, wrong floor, wrong door, wrong form, go away, I don't know and I don't care. And that's what the Unicity is, a massive cover for corruption. Looting of the country by professional politicians, parasites and thieves. But I repeat myself, what is a politician but a parasite and a thief? Crime, violence and murder. A government that can put up a sign warning you that it's a hijacking hotspot, but they can't deal with the hijacking. They can just put up a sign. And genocidal hatred tolerated and promoted by politicians. Having been in Rwanda during the Rwandan genocide, I don't think it's funny to have the government and the media whipping up people to hate and to stigmatize and to make a scapegoat of racial minority. That leads to genocide. Thinking of looting of farms and the murder of farmers in the Soviet Union, they called that decolonization. In Zimbabwe, they called it land reform, murdering farmers. Racial discrimination in the cancer-ruled South Africa is now called black economic empowerment. It doesn't empower any of the people on the ground. In fact, it just steals from them the service delivery they should have gotten. But they call it affirmative action now. Pick a card, any card. It just says the only cards you can pick are race cards. They have ridiculous things like white privilege conferences. I've actually been to one of those. But toleration of intolerance is cowardice. And we've got a lot of people tolerating the intolerance of Julius Malema and the EFF and so on. And this kind of, on the newspaper, main page, whites are to blame. I mean, really and truly. Here you've got a group that's been in power for 30 years and the blame is on the minority. Like, how can the minority be to blame for the mess that the majority have made and with a political party that's had monopoly for 30 years? But the power behind all is the Southern Communist Party. That ham and sickle there should be as offensive to you as anything in the world could possibly be. Under that ham and sickle, 160 million people have been murdered in the name of communism worldwide. But now all these kinds of BLF land grab plans, and that would be catastrophic. University of Cape Town, a student sitting there with a t-shirt, kill all whites. I mean, how's this engendering a nice environment of education? And in front of the police even, kill all whites. This isn't just words, people are doing it. There's a book out there that documents this, Kill the Boer, Government Complicity in South Africa's Brutal Farm Murders. And I think farm murders is the wrong word. Torture and terrorism would be more like it. This is a Ernst Rutz has been a guest here before, and he writes documents about the brutal reality, like Roger Solik and Christine Solik. These are victims of farm attacks. 66-year-old Dries Steenkamp, shot dead on his farm outside Lydenburg in Mpumalanga. Vanessa Staflu, whose 3 and 5-year-olds ran into the darkness after their mother had been murdered right in front of them. Imagine the trauma for those poor kids. I mean, you've got to put faces to these numbers. It's the story of Johan Stradom, whose skull was cracked with a piece of metal, after which he was dragged behind his bucky on a dirt road until he died of a burst liver. And it's the story of the mother who lost her will to live after a 21-year-old son, Carl Stoltz, was murdered on the farm close to Bloemfontein. And Ati Potgieter, who was stabbed 151 times with a panga, with a garden fork and with a knife, after which his mother and 2-year-old daughter, Wilhelmine, were murdered. These are the pictures, just some of the victims of these farm murders, and they've got crosses for the names of about 4,000 farmers and their family members who've been murdered in this country since Mandela became president in 1994. This is the result of genocidal hate whipped up with kill the Boer, kill the farmer, bring me my machine gun, kill, shoot to kill, bah, bah, shoot to kill, bah, bah. And thousands of supporters of the EFF dancing around in the stadium following Malema. It turns out that the most racist people are the ones crying racist all the time. In addition, these riots and these irresponsible threats of white genocide, of kill the Boer and kill the farmer songs, they're only driving down the value of the rand and further impoverishing the entire population, stealing from everyone. When Mandela became president, the South African rand was worth 2 rand to the dollar. Now, I remember as a teenager in the 70s, 1 rand was worth 3 American dollars. I remember going overseas and discovering that my rand was more powerful than the dollar, and more powerful than Deutschmark, more powerful than the British pound. Today, it's what, 19 rand to the dollar, 22, 24 rand to the pound? It's absolutely shocking. They've stolen from everyone. Ineptocracy is a term coined by the British, I think it's Economist newspaper in Britain. A system of government where the least capable to lead are elected by the least capable of producing, where the members of society least likely to sustain themselves or succeed are awarded with goods and services paid for by the confiscated wealth of a diminishing number of producers. Ineptocracy. The ANC epitomised that. In fact, some people say South Africa is like the Titanic. You know, it's going down. I would say, well, the difference between the Titanic and the ANC-led South Africa is when the Titanic went down, all the lights were on. And so South Africa struck the iceberg of the ANC. It's going down. and you can either go down to the Titanic or you can launch out in Cape Independence. And I've actually been talking about that for quite a while, and I see people now making memes on that. Big question, is there hope for our country? Plainly, what is needed and urgently needed are leaders with a clear, bold vision, fresh ideas, a workable plan of action, which can resonate with voters, because we do need to have voters choosing it. Notice the forests that used to be more common on the slopes of Lion's Head. It should go without saying that these leaders should be people of integrity and courage. That would be a nice change. Every crisis includes both danger and opportunity. In Chinese, they've got two characters. One is danger, the other is opportunity, and together they make crisis. I think that's always true. Every crisis has both danger and opportunity. At the moment, the ANC is divided, it's disgraced, and it's in disarray. And the leadership of the DA is doing something more than shooting itself in the foot. The DA are speculating about an alliance with the ANC. Now, spot something pretty weird here. Someone wearing a Vote ANC t-shirt holding a DA poster. Is this person confused or what? But now people are talking about the DANC, because the DA are talking about the possibility of being in alliance with the ANC, and the ANC are talking about the possibility of being in alliance with the DA. The ANC said publicly they would not consider an alliance under any circumstances with MK, Zuma's party, but they would consider an alliance with EFF and, if necessary, with the DA. Because at the moment, predictions are the DA is going to... Sorry, let me start this again. The predictions on the polls is that EFF is going to get 10 to 11%. ANC will get 32 to 34%. MK will get 17%. So statistically, the ANC and EFF together may not be able to form a majority. And if they're not willing to consider MK, that leaves the DA. And so it's possible that the ANC may align itself with the DA in order to stay in power. The DA may align itself with the ANC to get into power. So what's the whole point of the DA? The main reason most people vote for DA is for a strong opposition to ANC. Let me remind anyone who's forgotten, the National Party in 1999 campaigned on a Vote National Party for a strong opposition to the ANC. And what did they do after winning the Western Cape and Cape Town? They handed over to the ANC and they dissolved themselves, and the head of the National Party became cabinet minister in the ANC. And the only time Cape Town's ever been in the hands of the ANC was when the National Party gave it to them. After campaigning on Vote National Party for a strong opposition to the ANC, National Party handed Cape Town and Western Cape to the ANC, who looted so much of it, we're still trying to recover. Along with the massive unemployment and the outrageous levels of crime and violence, rampant inflation, riots, and general failure of governments on all levels, all this has created widespread dissatisfaction, dismay, and disillusionment. It's like the wheels are coming off. But there's encouraging signs, like the rise of nationalism worldwide, as experienced in the stunning Brexit vote of Great Britain in 2016, which was not meant to happen, because the government of Britain and the media of Britain, BBC and so on, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, all supported Remain in the EU. And yet you had these troublemakers with Brexit and Michael Farage, Nigel Farage, I should say, campaigning for Brexit. And Brexit vote won, and everyone was shocked. This is pretty well describing it. Angela Merkel in the crow's nest screaming, we need more immigration. And then you've got Greece getting sick over the side, and you've got the Eurozone weighed down with the debt. You've got a clown at the wheel. You've got the globalists trying to shoot at the Brexit party that's leaving, the shock of political correctness coming, the taxes weighing them down, and they're about to go, right, regulations tying poor people up in red tape, and they're about to go all the way down over the precipice of this waterfall. And so basically it was, do you want to go the way of British sovereignty, or do you want to stay in the EU globalism? And as the Brexit people said, we're not one race, we're not one global nation, we're not one global religion, we're not one liberal moral code, we're not one gender, we're not under one government, we're not globalists, we're not one, we're individuals. We're sovereign nations and we're exiting your system. Hear us loud and clear, you've been warned. Brexit. Brexit is a triumph for the simple idea that Britain should be governed by the British people. And you know where this started? The Queen made a speech back in 2014 that we're going to banish from this country. We're going to kick out the country. What's the word for it? When you evict? No, there's another word. When we're going to expel foreign citizens who commit crimes in Britain. And the EU said, you can't do that. It's against EU law. And British people were like, wait a minute, our queen, our sovereign, cannot enforce a law agreed to by the population we voted for that foreign criminals can be expelled from our territory. So we've just become a province of Brussels. And this is where Brexit really started to grow this outrage that we can't even evict people from our country who are criminals and who are foreigners, for that matter, and even came here illegally. And so the British lion started to stir. I wouldn't say exactly roared, but he at least sort of purred or something. And Britain decided we're going to regain our country for ourselves. And then there was the 2016 Trump revolution in America, which was not meant to happen. Our newspapers here were talking about 98% chance that Hillary's going to win. And even the day of Trump's victory being announced, the front page newspapers in Cape Town said, Hillary Clinton with her hands raised wide, and, Hillary wins. Front page of the Cape Times, the post they'd made them beforehand because everyone was convinced Trump didn't have a chance. But, you know, that's why we suddenly start to get fact checkers and censorship on the media, because he had no access to media, but he won through social media. And that's when Zuckerberg and Twitter and so on went berserk on over-regulating and banning, and they've banished hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Facebook profiles and platforms because of political correctness since. It's also seen a doubling of votes for Marine Le Pen's National Front in France. In fact, and her niece, Marion Le Pen, even more conservative. Absolutely extraordinary, the movement of the conservatives in France. The dramatic growth of the Freedom Party in Austria, the steady growth of parties throughout the European Union, like the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, which, by the way, even though it gets a third of the votes in Germany, is being investigated and spied on by the espionage unit of the German Federal Republic. I mean, imagine that you are considered a threat to the country because a third of the population want to vote for you. That's a threat to democracy. How dare people vote for other than what we tell you you're allowed to vote for? And this all indicates a dramatic increase of support for those rejecting politics as usual and globalization. In Austria, where my sister-in-law and quite a few relatives live, they've got a Glock 9mm pistol-packing chancellor, and you can see in Austria, the yellow show those who vote for the socialists, and the blue show those who vote for the nationalists in Austria. And plainly, geographically, the National Freedom Party has got much greater support in Austria. And interestingly, during the COVID cult, the government ordered the police and army to enforce very strict lockdowns. And then the chief of the army and the police said, "Ohne mich, without us, this is not our job. If you want to enforce that, do it yourself. The army and the police are not going to enforce this." And so Austria had to abandon some of the strictest lockdown rules in Europe because the police and army refused to carry out the government's regulations. Like, we're not going to do it. We're not going to arrest our neighbors for not getting a vaccine and things like that. So there is a bit of hope. And then you've got one of the few sane countries in Europe, Hungary, Viktor Orban, who whenever he wins the election, the American State Department says, this is a threat to democracy. The majority of Hungarians vote for a party that doesn't support the EU globalist nonsense. And he says, not one single Muslim migrant in Hungary, not one mosque. This is a Christian country. Now, isn't it amazing? That's a country that used to be communist. So now there might be a whole lot of other countries in Europe considering a exit out of the EU. I've been to the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, and it's a very interesting building. It deliberately modeled on the Tower of Babel. Incomplete, a building with scaffolding still visible, with a monument of a woman riding a beast. Doesn't it remind you of some biblical imagery in the book of Revelation? All this part of the Club of Rome, where the Vatican endorsed this whole idea of a single Europe. The Tower of Babel, as painted by the famous Belgian artist Bruegel, and the EU Parliament in Strasbourg. Any similarity is deliberate. This is the EU's poster. Europe, many tongues, one voice. Notice the star turned so that it forms the pentagram of Satanism. The horns and the ears and the goat beard of the goat, and the whole message, Europe, many tongues, one voice. What is it saying? We're going to reverse Babel. Direct fist of rebellion against Almighty God. And you can see the EU stands for that. So to resist this globalist World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, Illuminati type of synagogue of Satan, we say decentralize everything. Centralization is what the enemy wants. And there's other resistance. Look at the truckers in Canada who made a strong stand. Never expected any backbone in Canada, one of the most liberal countries on the planet, one of the worst governments in the world. And yet the truckers and the population rose up very powerfully. They were seriously crushed, but they did make a strong stand. Netherlands now is seeing one of the greatest risings of farmers who make a stand because their World Economic Forum Prime Minister Mark Rutte wanted to close down half the farms, euthanize half the cattle in the Netherlands. Now, the Netherlands is the second largest agricultural exporting country in the world. 100 billion euro industry a year of exports of agricultural products. And now Mark Rutte wanted to wipe out half the farms in Netherlands, and the farmers rose up with under no circumstances. And so they managed to cause such a revolution that they ousted this hideous World Economic Forum government of Mark Rutte. And this is in France, more farmers protesting. And in Germany, here's the German farmers rising up, and the Unter den Linden leading to Brandenburg Gate, very impressive. Massive protests. No farmers, no food, no future. How clear is that? If you surrender civilization to avoid social disapproval, you should know that all of history will curse you for your cowardliness. We're living in such a critical stage. Future generations could be much, much, much worse off. I'm concerned my children and grandchildren don't have as good a future as I had when I was born. And it's disgraceful that we should hand over to our children or grandchildren anything less than as at least as good as we had it, preferably better. And yet, here we've got, for the first time in a long time, children getting a worse future than their parents had, a lower standard of living, and so on. So the question is secession of the Cape viable? Well, some of the most successful countries in the world are products of secession, like Switzerland, who seceded from Austria in 1291. We had John Steenkamp of the DA say, secession is stupid and unworkable. Well, I beg to differ. Is Switzerland stupid? Is Switzerland unworkable? Switzerland came out of secession. The United States of America seceded from Great Britain in 1776. What do the Americans celebrate on the 4th of July? Secession from Great Britain. And the original 13 British colonies have, of course, grown, but that's where they started. Belgium seceded from Netherlands in 1830. Netherlands seceded from Spain in 1568. Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836. Remember the Alamo. And Nicaragua seceded from Guatemala in 1838. Norway seceded from Sweden in 1905. And the Republic of Ireland seceded from Great Britain in 1922. I think any Irish person will tell you, Ireland came out of secession. And by the way, Northern Ireland seceded from Southern Ireland immediately afterwards because Britain was happy to abandon all of Ireland. But the Protestant majority north said no, and they were willing to fight Great Britain to stay in Great Britain. And that's another secession actually right there. Northern Ireland doesn't want to be part of Catholic Southern Ireland, the Republic. They want to be part of the Great Britain United Kingdom. And the Northern Irish are called Royalists and Unionists. They believe in the Union with Great Britain. They believe in the Royal Family. They're probably the most fervent Royalists in the British Isles. So they've got another secession right there. Finland seceded from Russia in 1917. They didn't want to be part of the chaos of the Bolshevik Revolution, so they redrew the boundaries and started their own parliament and made themselves separate. And Finland's been a good, stable country. Pakistan seceded from India in 1947. And then East Pakistan, or Bangladesh, seceded from Pakistan in 1971. Singapore, which was an unpromising swamp with no natural resources, seceded from Malaysia in 1965 and has become one of the most successful economic powerhouses in the world today. And Singapore is an excellent example of a tax haven creating massive amounts of investment and employment. And then our friends in Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia, they seceded from Russia and the Soviet Union in 1991. Croatia and Slovenia seceded from Yugoslavia in 1991. I document those in detail in my book. Yugoslavia broke up the hideous Versailles Treaty mess of this land of the South Slavs. Six nations, five different languages, and four major religions, and three different alphabets, two calendars even, but only one political party, the Communist Party. It broke up in many places, and Croatia today is a stable, peaceful country. Eritrea seceded from Ethiopia in 1993. East Timor seceded from Indonesia in 2002, and Namibia seceded from South Africa in 1990. It used to be the fifth province of South Africa, and Namibia, or Southwest Africa, seceded, and they're doing better than we are doing these days. South Sudan, the youngest country in the world, seceded from Sudan in 2011. Muslim Arab North, Christian Black South, the leaders of the SPLA were highly skeptical that this was at all possible. But today, South Sudan is an independent country. Commander Salva Kiir is in the middle of this picture here, right next to me. He was second commander of the SPLA when I met with him in 2002, and he was arguing, secession is a good idea, but it'll never work. Not possible. They'll never redraw the map. And I said, you will always be a persecuted black Christian minority in an Arab Muslim majority country, unless you redraw the map to where you are the majority. And South Sudan is now a free and independent country, and Salva Kiir has been the president since 9th of July 2011. So this is just another example of how you often don't know that it's going to happen. The slogan we took was from Exodus, let my people go. Many people forget that Israel grew out of secession from Egypt. And they voted for secession, the ink on the finger showing that they voted. And a new dawn broke. South Sudan, youngest country in the world. Some of the war veterans who lost their limbs in the war. And the story behind the Texas hat is Commander Salva Kiir was taken by our friend Franklin Graham of Samaritan's Purse to Texas to meet his friend George Bush Jr., who's the president at the time. And George Bush gave Salva Kiir his Texas hat. And since then, Salva Kiir has worn it like a crown, and it's become the latest fashion in South Sudan that everyone wants a Texas hat. And he, being inaugurated, this says a lot. Someone who lost his hands in the war, raising his arm stumps to heaven and praise to God for the freedom and independence of South Sudan. So why can't Western Cape go free? We have a larger population, a bigger economy than Namibia. Namibia is doing quite well. And the Cape Republic would probably soon become bigger than the Western Cape, but you've got to start somewhere. Northern Cape and some of the Eastern Cape would probably join us. Remember, the Zulus recently celebrated 200 years of their establishment under King Shaka in 1816. A great accomplishment. But the Cape has been around for even longer than that. We've got a common heritage going back about 500 years in the Western Cape. Why should the Cape not be its own nation? And we've got the prayer of Jan van Riebeck. When he landed in Table Bay, he prayed in 1652, may God make this outpost for the spreading of the light of the Reformed faith throughout the continent of Africa and for the blessing of the indigenous people with the gospel. And he had a vision, a missionary vision for the Cape from the beginning. And Cape of Good Hope has grown since then. Oldest building in the Southern Hemisphere, the Castle of Good Hope. And there was a time when it was a lot cleaner and better maintained than it is now. But we've got a great heritage. There's just some of the flags that the Cape Castle has been under over the years. And we've got a future and a heritage. This is the oldest building in the Southern Hemisphere, just reminding us that the Cape's heritage goes back a lot longer than anywhere else in the Southern Hemisphere. And this is part of, this is where we'll probably read the Proclamation of Cape's Independence from the cut, as they call that balcony. If you've seen the film of Acts, the Book of Acts film, this is where they did the Pentecost baptism, which was filmed in what used to be called Lady Anne Barnard's Bath, which it was not, only it's called the Dolphin Pool more accurately. A lot of history and heritage going from the Dutch and the British, the Batavian Republic, all the way through to the Republic of South Africa, now the beach towel. But we've got a tremendous heritage in the Cape. By the way, this is what Table View used to look like. I remember there was a time when all there was springboks running around where today so much of Table View is built up. That's only happened in recent years. Few people can remember when Cape Town actually had a promenade pier. This would have been my grandparents' generation, not my parents. But that used to be popular, like the waterfronts as today, but that's now disappeared under the land reclaiming of the foreshore. And people used to come and go by a ship mostly. Just interesting, see, this is where the Cape Town National Conference Center is, in the Bartholomew Monument, and Fake News 24 is on those areas there now. So Cape Town has got a just look here at these old pictures. Look how much forest we used to have around Lionshead, how much has been deforested. We need to plant 10 million trees in the Western Cape to make up for what's been lost since 94. Not Western Cape, Cape Peninsula. Just see how much forestry we used to have. You can see all around, and how Adderley Street used to be pretty clean. Green. And green. And notice how much forest there was behind Sodom on the hillside, UCT here. Forest was going all the way up the hills. And I mean, again, what Kemp's Bay used to look like, and part of Clifton. And this is what Hout Bay used to look like. This is what a railway station used to look like. And what South African Airways stewardesses used to look like. Before they had flight attendants, we had stewardesses. Parliament. This is what police used to look like at the opening of Parliament. Opening of Parliament used to be a whole lot smarter event than these days. Silver Falcons, back when we had an Air Force. Yeah. Now, when you think of statues that should have been pulled down, isn't it strange? The Boers had this country from 1910. They never pulled down Queen Victoria's monument, under whom the Anglo-Boer War and the British concentration camps were on. If any statue should have been pulled down, you would have expected the Boers had every reason to pull down Queen Vic's statues, but they never did. Monuments are there to remind people of previous generations, and even if it's Genghis Khan, you'd want to have that monument up because it's still telling you something about history. And so there's people who just want to pull down monuments or pulling down history. And of course, remembering those who died in the wars, it should not be interfered with. This is remembering the many South Africans who died in the First and Second World War. And even this, by the way, might remind you, it's the same monument that you have in front of Union Buildings. This is in Cape Town Gardens. And it's a memorial in remembrance of those who died in the World Wars. There was a time when South Africa was Africa's superpower. I don't know that our military today could even be able to defeat the Botswana army, but notice, if you look at our old Union of South Africa crest, notice the lady holding the anchor. That's symbolic of the Cape. Cape's always had the anchor in it. Of course, the orange tree for the Orange Free State, and the Ossewaar for Transvaal, and the Wildebeest for Natal. In unity is strength. That was the old South Africa slogan. But how did the Union of South Africa come about? There was no voluntary union. It was no referendum. Nobody had a choice. We were a shotgun wedding. The British Empire had to force the bayonet after destroying 30,000 farms in the Free State and Transvaal, poisoning wells, killing millions of farm animals, forced the four provinces together. And so if the Union of South Africa is an artificial colonial construct, may we not deconstruct it? May we not have a referendum to break that union, which wasn't voluntary in the first place? Again, you get a look at what formed the original Union of South Africa in 1910. Well, we think it's long overdue to let the Cape part, the mother city, decide to break free. So what policies could ensure Cape independence to succeed? The basic building block of any successful society is the municipality. It's absolutely essential that the municipal control is handed back to the ratepayers and the homeowners. Decentralization is vital. The uni cities are expensive, catastrophic failures. And this civic center is an absolute minefield and cesspit. And to find the right floor, the right person, man with the key not being absent, and even to get parking and so on, the civic center is actually a mess. This city works for you is a lie. It does not. We're still paying 800% water tariffs for the drought that ended about 7 years ago. Cape independence can succeed following the decentralization confederation model of Switzerland and the free enterprise models of Hong Kong and Switzerland and Singapore. In order to attract investors, the Cape would need to slash taxes, preferably abolish them altogether, and we've got a way that we can do that. A nation trying to tax itself into prosperity is like a snake trying to eat itself from the tail up. It's that smart. You can't tax yourself into prosperity. But the Cape can become a tax haven. And if we can become a tax haven, we'll attract many investors, employers, and tourists, and literally hundreds of thousands of jobs would be created. Ultimately, millions more jobs would be created if we slash taxes. Singapore and Hong Kong were successful because they were tax havens. They had no natural resources. Do you know that one time Hong Kong had a bigger economy than Red China, mainland China? And that's because they were a tax haven. Free enterprise provides incentive by rewarding initiative and ingenuity and rewarding hard work. And we've got a lot in the Cape that can benefit. And you can see how free enterprise flourishes. Since the waterfront was made a place of enterprise and initiative, it's flourished. It would be essential to restore respect for life and property. And the quickest way to restore respect for life and property is decentralize the police force down to the local level. And we could consider the American model of voting for your local sheriff, your local police chief. Put it back in the hands of the municipality. Local police forces should be answerable to the local municipality, controlled by the homeowners and the ratepayers. This will quickly restore law and order on a local municipal level. The people most invested in the community, the ones who are paying the rates and taxes, if they control the municipality and the municipality controls their own police, those police will not stand by while their uncle's garages are burned down and their grandfather's farm is looted or grandmother's home is attacked or something like that. They'll get involved. And local police force would be more diligent. They'd also know who belongs. Tourists are attracted to beauty and nature in safe, clean, neat environments. It would be essential for us to restore our beaches, our parks, our forests, our mountains by eradicating crime, eradicating violence, eradicating litter and pollution and eyesores. Mosquitoes breed in stagnant water. In order to get rid of flies, you close the trash can and you move the trash can out of the kitchen. By removing the political trough for parasites and political opportunists, public life can be cleaned up. No career politician should be tolerated. I don't see why they need pensions for elected officials. Why should they get high salaries for elected officials? Mayors and town councillors and premiers and members of parliament should receive the same salary that teachers, policemen, firemen and nurses have. And no corruption should be tolerated. This is why we've got the mess we've got. We've got corrupt politicians ruining our society. Corruption and inflation steal the most. Socialism, affirmative action, and corruption are destroying economies. Honest money is needed. Our entire banking system needs to be reformed by abolishing usury, meaning charging of interest on funds. By ensuring that only taxpayers and homeowners vote in municipal elections, you'll quickly withdraw the incentive for the welfare junkies and economic parasites who like to flock into the area. And those on social welfare grants have forfeited their right to vote anyway. In the interest of removing conflicts of interest, those who need to be on any form of social welfare should not be voting on how to use other people's money. And you just think of how many people are in a stadium like here's Goodhope Stadium in Greenpoint. And we've had prayer vigils there. And I've thought, if everyone in that stadium were Christians, how much would that change in the society? Now, we've had prayer meetings of transformation prayer meetings where we filled a stadium. Well, if you had really 55,000 dedicated praying Christians in the city, seeking to be salt and light, witnessing to neighbors, we'd have a different city. Just a stadium. And that's a fraction of the population of the city. Now, looking at how people vote, there's no doubt that the Western Cape is a different voting pattern from the rest of the country. Why is it that we're under a government we've never voted for? Whether by a ward or of National Assembly, or whether you're looking at the provincial elections, the Western Cape has always tended to vote against the ANC. So what potential voting blocks can be mobilized to free us from the ANC-ruled South Africa? Well, ratepayers, by handing back municipal control to them. Homeowners, by granting them primary control of the municipalities. The people who've invested in their community, have built up their community. Parents, by handing back control of the schools to the local community and to the parents, we will attract those people as well. Conservationists and environmentalists will be attracted by our goal of reforesting the Cape. The Cape should be back to being wonderfully reforested. And this will attract more tourists as well, not to mention more rain. And we should follow the example of Europe in making like places for migrating animals to cross safely across roadways to reduce roadkill, to reduce accidents. Abolishing plastic bags. Rwanda did this. No plastic bags allowed. Waging war on litter and pollution. Cleaning up the beaches, oceans and parks. Criminalizing litter and pollution. We've got to think of the wildlife who are so often suffering because of the litter and the pollution. And yeah, I mean, even the ones that don't seem that lovable, they've got their place. I mean, snakes aren't exactly our favorites, but they do get rid of rats. And a good man is kind to his animals, but the wicked are cruel to theirs. And some of the birds like our ideas as well. This is what a police force should do. Stop the traffic in order to let the ducks cross. There's got to be time for compassion. Compassion is always an option. We once closed our mission down for the penguin rescue operation in 1994, and again 2000 when these Chinese oil tankers sank and deluged the whole coast with oil. We mobilized our staff to go and clean up penguins, feed penguins, wash them down, and it was a wonderful operation to see Cape Town come together to rescue the penguins. 55,000 penguins rescued in the year 2000, and it was done by 85,000 volunteers from within Cape Town. And by the way, government did nothing, not municipal, not provincial, not national government. And when the day came that we released these penguins into the ocean, the Minister of Environment photobombed the operation, got himself onto the front page of Argus. But he had done nothing except get in our way and frustrate matters. But the fact that Cape Town could unifiedly stop one of the worst ecological disasters ever happened, save an entire species of animals, the penguins, greatest animal rescue since the days of Noah. They were trying to say it was the greatest animal operation in history, and I remind them of Noah's Ark and said, yeah, it can be only second to that. Nevertheless, this just shows what can be done by volunteers. Our community's got the ability to do a lot more than government can do. You might recall national government came and decided to start shooting all the tars, the mountain goats on our mountains. Well, I'm so glad that I saw the mountain goats back when they were prevalent, and recently I've seen some climbing a mountain too, so a few have survived. Sand Parks was running around with snipers' rifles and shooting these poor tars because they said they weren't indigenous. They'd actually escaped from the Cape Town Zoo, which used to be at Devil's Peak, close to UCT and entrance to Rhodes Memorial. Well, they multiplied over the years, and they're still there, thankfully. But we'd want to bring animals back. Of course, there's rhino poaching and so on, and even the Western Cape, you've had some rhinos being poached, and we've got to make a strong stand to protect these endangered animals. And of course, canned lion hunting cannot be tolerated, even though there are some farms in the Western Cape that try to do it. Lions are magnificent creatures, and we should protect them. As for the cheetahs, yeah. Of course, pro-lifers could be attracted because an independent Cape could defund abortion and streamline adoption. It's absolutely criminal that we have the most innocent, helpless life of all threatened by abortion. And so every year we mobilize pro-lifers to go to the gates of Parliament to protest against the evil of abortion. Abortion is the ultimate child abuse. It's a national sin. How can we sing in Nkosi Sikelel Afrika and expect God to bless this country if we're killing our own children? How can it be that an abortion can cost, I'm probably wrong here, it's probably a lot more than 800 rand now, but let's say 1,000 rand, but adoption procedures can be 80,000. Why is it so expensive to adopt a child? That's mostly government paperwork. It's completely irrational. A person may say it's cheaper to abort and it's more expensive to raise a child or to adopt them, but why should adoption be made so complicated? Investors would be very attracted by us abolishing VAT and replacing it with total economic activity levy. It's been proven that 1% total economic activity levy in all bank transactions will bring in more income than all of our VAT and income tax combined. But we wouldn't need 1%, I'm told. The economists have said 0.5% would be sufficient. Well, how would you like our tax in the Cape to be slashed down to 0.5%? Why would anyone not want to support that? Businessmen should be attracted by our goal of abolishing bureaucratic red tape and time-wasting, expensive red tape regulations. And cyclists, like the Dutch government provides for the cyclists, and they have right of way, and they've got special cycling tracks and bridges and underpasses. we can make Cape Town a lot more cyclist friendly as well. And runners, by securing the parks and the forests and long distance runs that are safe and clean, that's a huge amount of the Cape love running. Hikers, securing clean, safe, reforested mountains. We love our mountains, and Cape Town's got a unique amount of mountain climbs to use. We've taken a lot of foreigners and visitors and guests up our mountains. Lovely harbours, yachts, water sports, paddlers. Religious communities would be very attracted by an independent Cape because we would respect freedom of religion and refuse intrusive interference and harassment by government. None of this registering religious practitioners and hate speech bills and all that sort of thing. Families should be attracted because the goal of an independent Cape is to return the right to parents to protect their own children, restoring parental control of education. Government doesn't care about your children more than you do. It's just insane that this idea that the government knows how to spend your money better than you do and the government knows how to care for your children better than you do, let the government decide. No, we would say the other way around. Equality is a slogan based on envy. It signifies nobody's going to occupy a higher place than I. Thou shalt not kill, put in the positive is, you shall preserve life. The right of people to protect themselves and their families from assault has got to be written into our constitution. The Second Amendment in America, which enables people to bear arms, has done more to make women equal than the entire feminist movement. Enabling women to purchase and own firearms does more to protect them than all the different feminist laws that they come out with. So by protecting the right to self-defense, freedom of religion, sanctity of life, sanctity of property, freedom of speech, freedom of communications, we can make the Cape a beacon of hope like a lighthouse, such as Switzerland has been through the centuries. Switzerland is a neutral, safe, productive, peaceful country which through armed neutrality and decentralization has been an absolute haven for many people over the years, that people have been able to flee from the ruinous world wars because here's a country that stays out of unnecessary conflicts and defends itself but won't interfere in other countries. And Switzerland doesn't have an army, Switzerland is an army. Now here we are at the southernmost tip of Africa, astride the cold Atlantic Ocean, the warm Indian Ocean, we also known as the Cape of Storms. So the Cape has endured storms, and we've had very major storms, typhoons even, and hurricanes, waves washing over our beach roads, and the Cape knows how to go through storms. And we may go through some storms before we are fully independent, but it would be worth it. We've got a magnificent country. By being a tax haven with minimal taxes and no usury tolerated in the banks, Cape Town can exceed the economic success of Hong Kong and Singapore. You can see further when you're standing on the shoulders of giants. Learning from examples of excellence and avoiding these failures, the footsteps of failure, we can go far. Cape Town's got some magnificent facilities. Cape Town International Conference Center. I was here for Cape Town 2010, the largest world missions conference in history. Participating in that was tremendous. We're a major crossroad in Cape Town. So who are our potential allies? How can we reach them? The Coloureds, the Malays, and all Afrikaans speakers in the Western Cape will be attracted by the possibility of regaining control over their own communities and respect for their language. Friends in Mitchell's Plain said to me, why is it that we can't have one single policeman who speaks our language in Mitchell's Plain? Where are the Coloured policemen? There's no Coloured policeman who speaks Afrikaans in Mitchell's Plain, they said. And all our police are from the Eastern Cape, they speak Khoisa, and they are in the pay of the drug dealers and the gangsters, and we get no help from them. Now that's not right. Mitchell's Plain should be able to protect their own people. And you think of the Malays in Boerkop, and they've got their own community, very unique culture. Why should they not be able to determine their own culture in their own area? And Hout Bay, you think of waterfront, environmentalists and conservationists like Sandkop will be attracted by the high priority for conservation and animal welfare. We've got the only place in the world with African penguins, and we are custodians to protect God's beautiful creatures. It's so important for us to stand up and protect God's creatures because the purity of a person's heart can quickly be measured by how they regard cats and other animals. You never know who's going to pop in. Got to be ready. Neighborhood watchers, ratepayer associations will be attracted by policies of decentralization, placing policing back in the hands of the municipalities and the communities, not to be determined by Pretoria. We need neighborhood watchers. And businesses and investors will be attracted by the abolition of taxes, the restoration of honest money, and a tax haven. Community radio stations like Radio Tigerberg and Radio Cape Pulpit, CCFM, other community radios will be open to these fresh, bold, innovative ideas, we hope. And then community newspapers like the Echo and the Tatler and the Tigerberger should be approached. We need to maximize the web and the emails and the Twitter accounts, Vimeo, YouTube, Facebook, all other social media platforms to get this message out. There's so much potential to get the word out. And whether they love you or hate you or unfriend you or block you, we're here to feed the sheep, not to entertain the goats. So we should post the truth. You shall know the truth will set you free. Effective video documentaries and clips promoting aspects of these solutions need to be edited and produced, of course. And public meetings and marches, protests. We've marched to Parliament multiple times, and so important to make a stand. Our prisons are overcrowded. The criminal justice system has plainly failed. Foreign criminals need to be expelled and banned from returning. And our prisons are shocking. They're not fit for any human habitation. No people should be forced into prisons. Prisons are not even biblical. In the Bible, you read about some people being locked up in prisons like Joseph, but that's in pagan prisons. God's people were to enforce rather restorative justice for minor crimes, restitution. Why put a person in prison where he's going to be brutalized? That's not going to improve anything. Restitution to the victims of the crime should be the norm. Execution for murder or rape should be the subject for a referendum. Respecting the right of self-defense and placing no unreasonable obstacles in the way of a law-abiding citizen to obtain firearms for self-defense would have a massive deterrent effect on violent crime. Take Switzerland, where every home has multiple weapons of war. Switzerland doesn't have home invasions. I mean, who would think of doing that in Switzerland? People don't even want to invade Switzerland in the middle of a world war because Switzerland believes in armed neutrality and they have well-armed citizens. Switzerland does not have an army. Switzerland is an army. Potential allies in the political realm would include Stephen Mitford Goodson had established the Abolish Usury Party, and they had an economic model that could work in reviving our economy in the Cape, and there must be people who support them who would be interested in supporting Cape independence. Usury leads to slavery, and you can just see the stats from someone like Stephen Goodson that he's documented. When I was growing up, city councillors and members of the parliament were not actually paid for their service. They received only basic expenses for travel. They needed to have real jobs to sustain them. I had a school teacher, Mr. Rhys Davies, who was our history teacher. I said, "Sir, how can you be a member of parliament and a teacher?" He said, "We don't get paid for being members of parliament. We need a real job too." And unfortunately, it seems that too many today who meant to be in public service see it as an opportunity to be a self-serving criminal and to loot public resources. Imagine if civil servants and members of parliament were again voluntary people donating their time to the community. You wouldn't get the same kind of parasitic influence then. The African Union reports over 25% of the gross domestic product of Africa is looted every year by government corruption. That means more than a quarter of the total wealth of Africa is stolen by so-called civil servants. That's 10 times more than all of foreign aid to Africa combined. Some have tried to say corruption doesn't hurt anyone. Actually, corruption steals from absolutely everyone. It chases away tourists, it chases away investors, job creators, it devalues the currency. It reduces the value of everyone's savings, earnings, and pensions, and erodes and implodes any economy. Corruption, more than any other single cause, is responsible for most of the poverty and joblessness in society. To have people who have looted billions from the public treasury, to try and say it's the fault of some other race, some other people, some other time, and ignore what they've done, they've stolen so much that would have enriched the local community. Which is why we like the slogan of Moses in the book of Exodus, "Let my people go." Free the Cape, Cape exit. In 2022, on Freedom Day, in April 27th, we marched in Cape Town. Thousands of Capetonians made a stand, flying Cape Independence flags and different political parties that support Cape Independence and the Cape exit movement. We're marching Cape Independence, Cape Freedom March. Don't just hope for a better life. We're in an election year. We've got a chance to vote for parties that support Cape Independence. So any questions, any comments, complaints? It's important to know our history. We are going to have this video and others up like it on our video resources, audio and video resources we'll have on frontlinemissionessay.org, this presentation and others that we've done in the series. We've now produced the book, A Case for Secession, and just the cover and the inside covers showing you 23 examples of excellence of countries that were results of secession. I think can argue our case and disprove John Steenhuisen's ridiculous, ignorant comment saying that secession is unworkable and stupid, because it certainly isn't. It's an intelligent choice in a situation like we're facing now. Case for Secession is also available internationally as an ebook and on print on demand. Internationally, you can get it in Australia, New Zealand, Canada by going through Lulu. And we've got a website set up, www.capeofgoodhope.africa. Any questions? Comments, complaints? I know it's a lot to assimilate, but any feedback for Christians?
We were discussing earlier, sadly to say that I haven't seen enough people getting involved in creating awareness. You know, it's like, how can we actually do more? Because the majority of people are completely ignorant to what secession even means.
Well, there's several answers to that. The one thing is personal conversations with your chemist, your grocer, hairdresser, dentist, doctors. Not that you can say much to your dentist because they've got the floor, but anyway, they've got a captive audience, but you can give them some material. Now, of course, we've got the book that we can hand out to people that we know and trust and would like to get them discussing it. We can organize book launches in our home, school or church, but or a ratepayer association, something like that. Also, social media, what we post on Facebook or Twitter or any of these other places with links to, for example, capeofgoodhope.africa website. I think because you can get a lot of the answers on there, and we're trying to load these videos and presentations on all aspects of Cape Independence onto the capeofgoodhope.africa website. In the meantime, they're all on the frontlinemissionessay.org website as well. I think social media, conversations, book launches, getting guest speakers in, such as Des Palm from Cape Exit, or people, especially as we're heading up to elections, drawing people's attention to the savotersguide.org website, savotersguide.org.za, I should say. That's the correct site now. Shows that the parties stand in different positions. But to get people thinking and trying to consider it from a biblical point of view, or what are some of the most successful countries in the world? And the funny thing is, as you'll see from the pull-up banner at the back, well, most of the successful countries in the world came out of secession. Just something to think about right there. We've got the flags, 23 of them, on the book cover. But when we get people thinking about the subject, I sometimes start conversations like this, saying, do you realize that out of every rand we spend in taxes, we only get 12 cents of each rand spent back in the Western Cape? And most of that is misspent. Imagine if we could slash our taxes down to 10% of what they are now. Because if we just kept our taxes within the Western Cape, we could bring our taxes down to 10%, but we've got a better plan than that. That's total economic activity levy. Another thing you can point out is, if we were independent in the Western Cape, we wouldn't need power failures. We're totally energy sufficient in the Western Cape, and the only reason we have load shedding is because we're on national grid and we've got to share with the rest of the country who have less power stations. And the reason why they have less power stations is they've closed a lot of fully working coal stations because they took a 6 billion euro bribe from the European Union to close down those coal stations in a goal of heading for green energy. But in the meantime, we're getting all these power failures because working power stations, viable power stations, were closed by Europe. By the way, the same Europe that since then has ordered millions of tons of coal from us. So we are exporting coal to them while we're closing down our coal plants here. And this is, and the government gets a bribe to do this, not in the best interest of the people. So just something as simple as power failures or taxes gets people's thoughts going. But then you can bring up other points. You know, John Steenhuisen said secession is stupid and unworkable. Well, do you think that that's true to say of Singapore or Namibia or Switzerland? I mean, most people would agree, you know, those are successful countries. So you can get conversations going. I think it should be something people are thinking about. Do we want to continue in this abusive relationship of what's going on in South Africa. I sometimes use the phrase which I've been using for years now. You know, either we go down with the SA Titanic or we launch out in the Cape of Good Hope lifeboat. And just getting people thinking. Most people think it's a good idea, but it'll never work. Well, to be honest, I thought that about Croatia and Slovenia as well, and Slovakia, Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia. I didn't think their secessions were viable either. Even though I was the primary campaigner for South Sudan's independence, I didn't exactly think we'd succeed either. I knew it was a good idea, and I defended the case to Salva Kiir and others like John Garang of the SPLA. But I didn't think I'd see it happen in my lifetime. I knew it was a good idea and a good goal to work for. But I was pleasantly surprised when it all worked out. I mean, I was ecstatic when it worked out. But I didn't really believe we'd succeed when I started. But sometimes you have to start on something because you know it's the right thing to do. And, you know, these things are in God's hands. Duty is ours. The results are in God's hands. I can only do what I can do. I must do the best I can do. I must do everything I can do, and then I've got to trust God to do what I cannot do, which is most of it, actually. So, getting the conversation started, and the books, of course, are there to help. We've printed the book and made it available at absolute rock bottom price, because the printer did it for us at cost. We paid for the ink and the binding and the paper, but he didn't charge us for the labor, which they normally would. So we're selling the book at retail for 50 Rand a book, which is a very low price for a book with so much color in it too. But we're giving discounts of 50% for people buying 10 or more and 60% for people buying 100 or more. And that means that a person can resell and get a decent profit. I mean, 50 and 60% discounts are normally unheard of. So this can really reach a lot of people, so as not to put any restrictions on the distribution, having it at the maximum amount of discount, I think, is a good incentive. Hopefully the independence groups will see the benefit and use this as a weapon of information in next weeks leading up to the elections. 29 May is the next elections. So we're less than 2 months away from the elections. Gives us a good goal, because it's close enough to give people a sense of urgency, but it's far enough away to give us time. The more meetings we can organize, the more opportunities. I'm trying on what radio opportunities I get to communicate these things. Any other comments or questions? Dylan.
With all this Eskom and the load shedding, South Africa must be one of the best entrepreneurs in the world.
That's a good point.
With the restaurants and the barbers and that stuff.
And our farmers are some of the most tough, innovative farmers on the planet. Yes, if you can manage under lockdowns and load shedding and all that sort of thing, and with BBBEE regulations, then, you know, people here are very innovative, and I think we've got tremendous amount of innovation in the Western Cape, and we've got solutions. By the way, my goal next week, I've invited the leaders of all the different Cape independence movement groups to come for a panel discussion and to answer questions from the audience and to deal with all these questions, so you can hopefully, if they all respond as I invited them, Jack Miller, Des Palm, Phil Craig, Dr. Corne Mulder, if we can get them all here next week, then we'll have a chance to ask them questions, what's their solution for this and how they answer that and what will we do if and so on. So that's the goal for next week, which is the 11th of April, to have a panel discussion. And we've been asked by Loving Life TV to do a live broadcast, so we're going to record it for TV. The Australian-based Loving Life TV particularly asked us to get them together for a panel discussion. I thought let's integrate it with the Reformation Society meeting. So let's see if we can get some friends next week. If they want to meet these leaders and ask some questions, that'll be the opportunity next week.
Next week Thursday.
Next week Thursday for the 6 o'clock supper, we'll hopefully have them too, so they can get some more time to ask people's questions during the supper. And then 7 o'clock presentation, the 11th of April. Yes. Between the DA and?
ANC.
Yes, I think DA and ANC coalition is very likely. I mentioned earlier, what our Cape Independence people are hoping is that they will make a coalition with the DA in the Western Cape to keep the ANC out and the other groups, on the condition that the DA agrees to a referendum, that'll be a condition of them helping in a DA coalition in the Western Cape. So if the DA can be brought under 50% in the Western Cape, then they may be forced to go for referendum, because while the DA's got national aspirations, it's been proven by polls that the vast majority of DA supporters in the Western Cape support a referendum for Cape independence. So the DA wants national aspirations, they want the whole country, but they can't ignore their support base in the Western Cape. They could lose all their support base if they continue to show contempt for secession. That could easily happen. That is a scenario that I foresee, that the DA could campaign on vote for us to fight against ANC, only to join the ANC in a coalition afterwards. But while they might get away with in other parts of the country, the Western Cape is very much more leaning towards secession, especially the overwhelming majority of coloured people in the Western Cape have been treated so unfairly and so unjustly that they are ready for taking back control of the Cape. Bear in mind, more than 50% of the population of Western Cape is coloured and has Afrikaans as their main language. So why should the Western Cape be treated in such a way, and why should Afrikaans be relegated? It should be a national language here. And so we could see a lot of changes taking place. But the main thing is decentralisation, where Rondebosch runs Rondebosch and Paarl runs Paarl and Wellington and Worcester run Wellington and Worcester, and Mitchell's Plain regains control of Mitchell's Plain, Boerkop runs Boerkop. This gives hope for the future, because people will feel pride in their communities again when they gain control. I can't change the whole of Cape Town. The only city is beyond us. But we can do something in our suburb. Yeah. And that gives hope.
Where also your municipal workers actually come from your community.
That's the idea. Even the police should come from the local community. Then we'll have investment in the community and stability. We can do with a bit of stability.
Yeah. Is there anything
planned for the 27th this year? For Freedom Day, yeah. 2 years ago we did the Freedom March. It would be nice to do something else on it. I'm not aware that anything's been particularly planned, but that would be an excellent idea, a Freedom March again for the 27th of April. Thank you for the reminder. I think that's a very good idea. We must try and put that to our various leaders of different Cape independence movements. By the way, we once had a Cape independence strategy meeting here. Wolfram, were you here for that? Mm-hmm. Up here, I think we had about 24 people here, and it included members of parliament, city councillors, heads of parties, strategists, economists. It was a very good, high-powered group and constructive time, and we were discussing what would be needed for independence. And basically, there's an agreement to take about a 5-year process to reach Cape independence. Although it can happen quicker than that. I was astounded how quickly Slovenia, Slovakia, Croatia got the independence. Within a very short time of my hearing it the first time, they were independent. So some things can accelerate processes. Like in 2019, Cape Exit had 7,000 members signed up. After lockdown lunacy and the riots in KZN, their membership soared to 840,000. So that's not a straight line growth, that's very exponential, but that was, some things can accelerate and expedite a growth and movement towards Cape independence, like the collapse of the Soviet Union led to the independence of Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia and things like that. So the Berlin Wall coming down led to secession of Croatia, of Czech and Slovakia. So I think the way things are going, the more central government fails and the more power failures are and so on, the more likely different parts of South Africa are going to secede. Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who is a good friend, was speaking about the need to restore the kingdom of KwaZulu, and I think it's possible that KwaZulu might even break away before the Cape. The way we're going, I think the Cape will be independent first and KwaZulu would be immediately afterwards. But there's other parts of South Africa that would break away as well. It just needs one group, and that would then very much weaken central government and ANC, who've looted the whole country, could then really see the chickens come home to roost. Any other questions, comments?
If they keep the country dark to put off, to put on again, then maybe
yeah.
The country.
Yeah, well, at the moment there's a lot rumbling. There's a lot of people saying we need new leaders, and well, that's all fine, but they need a good plan. And I think we've got a very good plan in the Western Cape, and we've got a lot going for us here. We've got mountains, rocky shores, very defendable area, mountains and forest and desert to the north and to the east of us. We could easily build our own country in the Western Cape, and Western Cape was its own country for hundreds of years before the rest of the country started to build cities and so on. So I don't see why the Cape can't succeed. We've got everything going for us. All we need is the will. If the people in the Cape see the case for secession, I believe they will be enthusiastic for it. It's a matter of knowledge. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. So we need to communicate the facts, which is what the Case for Secession book is primarily there for.